New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. My name is Jana Rogge. I'm sitting here in my role as the managing editor of the New Thinking Aloud magazine. And I think sitting here in this chair makes me a guest host on this channel because my interviewee or my guest for today is Jeffrey Mishlove, who is the originator and the original host of New Thinking Aloud. And I asked him that we could have an interview with Jeff about his experience in remote viewing and his explorations in the consciousness and parapsychology field. Jeff is the author of three books. The Roots of Consciousness was the first one. The second one is actually his dissertation in parapsychology. You're the only person to date that holds a doctorate degree in parapsychology.
Well, I have a diploma that says parapsychology. Yeah. That's the unique part, because truly there are hundreds of people who have done doctoral dissertations on parapsychological topics. Oh. Their diplomas just don't say parapsychology.
Okay. And this book is called Psi Development Systems. I was able to read it. Thank you, Jeff. It's out of print, but you can still get some copies out there in the internet. And the third book that you wrote is The PK Man, the most recent one. Okay, welcome, Jeff, to your channel.
Thank you, Jana. And it's such a pleasure to be here with you. I'm so delighted that you have come all the way from Germany to Albuquerque to interview me.
Yeah, it wouldn't be so easy to invite you over there to Germany. Mm-hmm. Or maybe, I didn't ask you.
No, maybe. Maybe we'll do that sometime.
Okay, so let's dive into the topic. Remote viewing is my background. Yeah. And I heard you talking about your experience in remote viewing before. We have a presentation for IRVA in one of their conferences and an interview in the Aperture magazine. But I would be interested to hear the full story.
As a doctoral student in parapsychology at Berkeley in the 1970s, I was part of a community. There was a group of about 30, 40 people in the San Francisco Bay Area who all had a very serious interest in parapsychology. They included people like Charlie Tart, like Stanley Krippner, like Russell Targ and Keith Harari and Hal Puthoff and Arthur Hastings and many, many other people. And so we were all colleagues. We all knew each other. And because I was new to the field, just still a graduate student, the other members of this community were all very supportive. And of course, we all knew about the remote viewing research at SRI that was going on, and that it had government funding and probably funding from the CIA and other intelligence organizations. It was an open secret, I suppose it's fair to say. In fact, Russell and Hal had given talks about it. They'd already published articles and published books. And so on one occasion, they invited me to come to SRI and see for myself exactly what they were doing. And I showed up one afternoon, and to be precise, I showed up before lunch. And so the first thing they did was invite me to have lunch with them. And in a way, that's part of the ritual, because they have, if you're used to student cafeterias, which I was being a student, the cafeteria at SRI International was a cut above. Definitely. The food was better. The tables were better. Everything was more professional. You had, you know, a staff of highly educated professionals all there working in a large military industrial complex. So the ambiance was such that when Russell Targ would say, you know, everybody can do remote viewing, and everybody who comes here does it well. We don't have failures. We know that everybody can do it. It's almost like a hypnotic command.
He said they don't have failures.
No, that wasn't his exact words. Okay, yeah. No, but that was the implication. The idea was, even the government contract monitors who show up to see if we're cheating or something and trying to, you know, fool the government. And so we tell them, no, you can do it. And that's how they continue to get money year after year from the government, was by using the contract monitors themselves as research subjects, so that they had no doubt that this is an authentic phenomenon.
Yeah, I heard Hal talking about it. And also Russell reports about it. It's a good move to just have the visitors or the overseers doing their own work. Mm-hmm. But still, they had to find out first that it works for everybody.
Well, they seem to have enormous confidence, yeah. And I think Russell was largely the person who exhibited that, as I recall. He was the kind of person, he had this laser-like mind, and if he said something, it was so believable when it came from him. Very precise, very scientific, you know, background in physics and engineering, and you're in this very formal, very well-financed institutions surrounded by PhD scientists and engineers everywhere, and, you know, being served a very nice lunch.
Which year was
this? Was 1976. It was February.
This was before they published their book, but after the IEEE?
They had already published in Nature. They had already published, to my recollection, in IEEE. I don't recall what year the book Mind Reach or Mind at Large.
Mind Reach must be the first.
Mind Reach was their first book. I think it had been published by then.
1977, if I recall correctly, December 77.
Okay, then you know. But the truth is, they were giving talks at some of the small research groups. I was already affiliated with the Institute for the Study of Consciousness at Berkeley, founded by Arthur M. Young, the inventor of the Bell helicopter. I had been invited to live there with him, and I did for about 6 months. And after I moved out, because I moved in with my girlfriend, and that would not have been acceptable at the institution, so we moved elsewhere. And I maintained a strong connection there, and Arthur Young had actually contributed financially to some of the work at SRI. And so Hal and Russ had given talks there years before about their work. And so by 1976, I had been friendly with them and aware of their work for several years.
Yeah, 1976, you were already in your working process for your dissertation.
I had entered the parapsychology individual interdisciplinary doctoral program that I created at Berkeley in the spring of 1973, in March of 73. I made the transition from criminology to parapsychology. So by February of 76, I was well into it. I had not yet really started my dissertation work. I was still doing background research. I had the year before, 1975, published my first book while I was still a graduate student, The Roots of Consciousness.
And you had Charles Tart on your committee.
Charles Tart was a committee member, and he was also one of the SRI researchers, as I recall. He had taken a sabbatical from UC Davis to work at SRI, but I'm not sure exactly what year.
Okay, let's get back to the cafeteria and your lunch. And what happened?
So I think, you know, the cafeteria experience, I regarded as part of the whole ritual that they took people through. It was like, first we'll have a meal together, you know, the Last Supper or something.
Didn't tell you it's working for everybody and put some pressure on you.
It wasn't a feeling of pressure. It was a feeling of ease, actually. It was a feeling like I'm in good hands. These people really know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. That was the feeling. But if you were to regard every normal experience in life as having hypnotic possibilities, that's what was taking place, mm-hmm. in a way. It was a kind of acculturation. There was almost a hypnotic quality to it, like, you can do this. You will do this. And then we went up to their offices, which I recall were in a building called the Radio Science Laboratory.
They had this cube on the rooftop, right?
I don't know about that. I think we were up on the second floor.
Oh, okay.
And also there is the Faraday cage. It wasn't a cage. It was a very solid, sealed room. So electromagnetic signals couldn't penetrate into that room. There was no way that if I wanted to cheat by using a walkie-talkie or any kind of radio signals, it wouldn't have worked, mm-hmm. in that room. But I should say parenthetically, while I was there, both before and after the remote viewing experiment, which was successful, something else was going on. The place was abuzz, actually, and it was because of a man named Ted Owens.
Oh, yeah.
And Hal and Russ had achieved a lot of notoriety for working with Uri Geller, the Israeli psychic. And in fact, Arthur Young, my mentor at the time, had financed some of that research. And
yeah, and Ted had written to them, to Hal.
Ted Owens had written to Puthoff and Targ when their work with Uri Geller achieved notoriety, which it did. He said, you know, why are you wasting your time with this Israeli psychic? I'm the world's greatest psychic. Mm-hmm. And he kept sending them messages of that sort. And they kept ignoring him. They didn't want to have another flamboyant psychic. They already felt that they had gotten too much publicity, too much controversy from Uri Geller. The last thing they wanted was another. But Ted Owens kept persisting, and he had said to them early on, because in February of 76, there was a big drought going on in California. It was a serious drought. People had in that era little signs in their bathrooms that said, if it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down. So we weren't flushing our toilets. Yeah. And Ted Owens said, I'm going to prove to you I'm the world's greatest psychic. I'm going to end the drought. Mm-hmm. And you're going to know that I ended it, because it's going to happen within days. And at the time, the newspapers were saying no end in sight to the drought. Mm-hmm. He said, it'll happen within days. Your local newspaper will publish a front page story saying the drought is over. There's going to be rain and snow and sleet and hail and every kind of wild weather. And furthermore, there will be power blackouts and UFO sightings, which are my trademarks, he said, because he worked with UFOs. Well, lo and
still
behold,
it could be a simple prediction, not that he
could be a prediction, and it happened.
Yeah,
as he said it would, and so Russell Targ wrote back to him and said that was a good prediction, and Ted Owens responded by in effect saying, "Hell no, it was no prediction. I caused it." And so they didn't know what to do, and on the one hand, this is like a huge parapsychological phenomenon that deserved to be researched. On the other hand, they wanted no part of it. And they're getting funding from the CIA. They didn't need this sort of controversy. So here I am, a promising young graduate student. And they basically said, would you please take all of our files on this character and follow up? Which I did.
Yes.
So all of that happened the same day. And then we went into the sealed room, which was painted just like this studio, as I remember. The walls were all black.
Black?
Yeah.
Not gray. Black, okay.
That's my recollection.
Yeah.
And I sat down with Russell Targ, and he said very simply, close your eyes, ask your subconscious mind to give you permission to receive imagery of the target location. And in those days, they used the outbound experimenter method. And the outbound experimenter in that instance was Elizabeth Rauscher, who was a physicist, also a member of this tight-knit circle of parapsychology researchers and a good friend of mine.
And well known for her work in parapsychology.
She had a lengthy book about remote viewing. I think some editions were published, I'm pretty sure, by the Institute for Future Science. So she went out and was going to arrive at the target a half hour later. I was relaxing and chatting with Russell, and then I closed my eyes, and I had this image and drew a picture of it. Of it in my mind, what I was looking at, what I thought I was seeing was a rack of hangers. It looked like wires and
Was it the same target that Heller Hammond did?
Exactly. The actual target was the highway overpass over Highway 101. But I said to Russell, I said, I'm looking at a rack of clothing. I think they're at Macy's. And Russell, to his good credit, right away realized analytical overlay. I don't know that the word existed at the time, but he knew that I was interpreting. And so he said, no, step back and just describe the raw images. And I did, and I made drawings. And Elizabeth came back, and she said, you've made perfect drawings of the actual target, almost photographic. You could lay my drawing over a photograph of the highway overpass. And I had described other things, the blue sky, looking at the overpass itself had a cyclone fence around it with wire mesh covering it. And, so I actually think my drawing was probably better than the one Hella Hammond made, which is so famous.
Yeah, I've seen yours, and maybe you can just...
Yeah, we can show it.
We can show it, yeah.
Yeah. So that was it, and it convinced me of two things. Number one, that my attempt to interpret what I was seeing was certainly wrong, completely wrong, couldn't have been more wrong, but my actual raw impressions were dead on. And I think that experience, I hear Russell and other people using that experience as sort of archetypal for explaining to people how remote viewing works.
I think I heard Russell mentioning that, first, the role of the interviewer is trying to keep the viewer away from naming things.
Yeah.
And that they found that sticking with descriptions helps you to get better.
Exactly. Those are two of the fundamental principles of remote viewing, and I exhibited both of them. And So I went on to study Ted Owens, and I went on to incorporate remote viewing into my dissertation program. Mm-hmm. I set up an 8-week training program to train people in remote viewing in the summer of 77, the next summer. And I led several seminars back in that era. I was
8 weeks means once a week for 8 weeks?
Like a summer program. I had the sponsorship of the University of California Extension System, and we offered it as an 8-week course meeting every day.
Wow.
5 days a week for 8 weeks to talk about training remote viewing, officially sponsored by the university. And I thought that would become the basis of my dissertation. Mm-hmm. But what I found was actually what I had predicted, that the students did very well initially. Their very first trial, they did well. And then after that, their scores dropped dramatically. And what I predicted is what we would call statistically a J-curve. Their scores dropped, and then they went back up after they had more training and became more comfortable with the idea. Because, you know, at first, beginners seem to do quite well, and then they begin to say, oh, what did I do? Mm-hmm. And the implications of doing well in remote viewing when you're in a materialistic culture, it frightens people a little bit. It causes a certain amount of anxiety. And so we worked through that in the training program. Their scores went up. I wanted to make that the central part of my dissertation, but I made a statistical error, which is actually not a lot of people know about this. I wasn't appreciative of enough at the time, and my faculty members who were advising me didn't catch it either. It's called the stacking effect.
Yeah.
Which is when you have multiple people, we had about a dozen viewers, all looking at the same target at the same time. And in that instance, you cannot treat them as independent of each other, because there's always the risk that, there might have been some item in the news that day that they all heard in the morning that influenced their viewing. So you have to treat them as, in effect, to be the most conservative, treat all 12 of them as one person. You could do that. And which is not a large enough sample to make any statistical conclusions from. So I had to rework my whole dissertation at that point. And so if you read the book, Psi Development Systems, you'll see that it's a historical and systems analysis of methods for training psychic abilities, and with only passing mention of the 8-week training program that I did.
Yeah, but also in this book, you lay out several experimental settings mm-hmm. that can be used for investigating.
Yes, I
so did. You had 12 students in this group?
Roughly.
A dozen, yeah. Which is, so working for 8 weeks each day makes a good sample size.
It would have been, if I could treat them as independent, it would have been highly statistically significant. But I realized after I became more familiar with the stacking effect that what you need to do in that circumstance, and what I've always done subsequently in working with groups of people, is to have a separate target for each individual. So that way, if they're not all looking at the same target at the same time, then you can treat them as independent.
Mm-hmm. Okay, or either you could have them looking at the same target different times. Yeah.
You could, but I think, you know, a critic might fault that as well, depending on how far apart the times were and so on. But for applied work, you don't have to worry about statistical significance in the same way as when you're a graduate student doing your dissertation.
Yeah, right. But in a scientific context, we want to have clean
You do. You want it. But I know Russell, for example, and many other people who do workshops and seminars in remote viewing, you have a group of 30, 40 people in the room and you give them all a target and they all do it at the same time. And many people will have direct hits and they're very happy with that. And you don't worry about publishing it in an academic journal.
Yeah. But so even if you didn't have the statistical evidence, did you show the decline effect or the J curve?
Well, I did in my first draft, but after that it became I couldn't use it because
No, my question is if the data shows this effect. I've heard about it many times that there is this, we can call it a first time effect.
Yeah.
Or if it then drops, the decline effect. Or you call it a J curve because it goes up again.
Yes.
Training. Yeah.
With training.
Yeah. But this is a very well known phenomenon in the remote viewing or Psy world.
Yes.
And what do you think about the cause?
The cause of the, you've got three things going on. You have the initial high score, the first time effect, sometimes it's called the beginner's luck effect. The people are naive. Many people think, well, this is impossible, but I'll try it anyway. And lo and behold, they surprise themselves. I've seen people come up with people who never thought they had any psychic abilities can produce remote viewings that are 100% accurate on complex targets the first time. I've seen that. And then when they try it the second, the third, the fourth time, all of a sudden they feel different about it because now they know they've done it. But so they feel on the one hand, pressure is on them to do it again. And they don't know for sure how they did it. We still aren't sure how they did it. And there's also a lot of anxiety, like, what will my parents say? What will my friends say? People might think I'm crazy. Fear of Psy, I think, is a very real phenomenon. It's why, for example, I'm still, after 40 years, the only person with a doctoral diploma that says parapsychology. Why is that? There's a taboo. Yeah. And so there's all this social stuff in the background. You could just call it mental noise, but for individuals, it's quite emotional. And over time in this 8-week training program, but for other people in training, you become more accustomed to it. It doesn't become so strange. You can begin to approach the phenomenon in a more matter-of-fact way, and your scores will improve.
Mm-hmm. And have you done other experiments with Hal and Russell later?
No.
Only this?
That was it.
And, one singular.
Yeah, and I really moved away from remote viewing. I got much more interested in field studies. I ended up, in effect, doing a 10-year field study with Ted Owens that resulted in the book, The PK Man, that wasn't published until the year 2000.
But still you have own experiences in applied Psy, so to speak, not only remote viewing, but in general.
Yeah, I began looking, I began doing many other things. And at the same time, I went through, to be honest, a dark period in my life, which is because as I got closer and closer to completing my doctoral work, the university put up more and more hurdles. And I, as I was telling you a little earlier, there was a faculty member on my committee, a statistician who saw himself as a hatchet man and did everything he could to prevent me from graduating with a doctoral degree in parapsychology, to the point where any time I turned in any papers about my research, he simply said, "This is totally and irretrievably incompetent, and I will not approve it." And refused to say why. So I don't even have to say why this is so bad. It's so terrible. And I had to struggle with him for years over this. And finally went to the dean of the graduate division at the time. And he said, oh, no problem. He said, I'll issue a directive. If he finds fault with your work, he has to say why. And if he doesn't, if he continues to refuse to even say why he thinks your work is incompetent, we'll remove him from the committee. And that's exactly what happened. So I replaced him on the committee, restructured my dissertation to include more of an overview of methods for training psychic abilities from historical perspective, from the perspective of education, evaluation, and systems theory. That's what psi development systems turned into at the end of the day.
It's a very comprehensive overview over all the different kinds of methods and
divided means of training ESP into experimental, looking at the literature, the research literature, historical, looking at ancient systems, yoga, shamanism.
And what you call the pre-science.
The pre-scientific traditions. And then also many different popular programs that were out in the culture.
You also made the division between intentional and non-intentional development of psi. Yeah. Yeah, an interesting read. And it's more like a lexicon to study the field.
And it suited me in the sense that if you've seen The Roots of Consciousness, my first book, my mind tends to gravitate towards overviews, towards sort of an encyclopedic approach to these things. So I was able to describe dozens of different ESP training programs and looked at the features that they had in common and the features that made each of them unique.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of in line with what you're still doing, talking to everybody in the field, getting an overview. And
you could say that The Roots of Consciousness, which was later called an encyclopedia, and New Thinking Aloud is in fact encyclopedic in nature with over 1,000 interviews now in the archives.
Yeah. It, in my opinion, it has a second level. The first level is getting into the different topics and learning more about the topics, but then if you have all of them in one place and look from above, you may be able to see a pattern. Mm-hmm. And an underlying structure in all these different kinds of working methods and experiences.
Yeah. And you know what I discovered from doing interviews, which actually I began doing these interviews even before I entered the doctoral program at Berkeley. I began doing them in 1972, and I was guided by dreams to do that. I felt like, to be honest, yes, I have felt like I've had guidance all the way through. And I suspect you have a similar feeling about your work. As a matter of fact, and many people don't talk about it as openly as I have, but I think many people in this field have a sense that the universe has been helping them along in different ways.
Yeah, there are big and small events that happen that you can call guidance. Mm-hmm. There are some very obvious things and some that are subtle, and you just in looking back to what happened, you will see, oh, yes, this was probably guidance, mm-hmm. how this happened, mm-hmm. or even what we call synchronicities. And you told me a very nice story about synchronicities. Maybe you can tell it again.
When I was a graduate student in criminology, the most powerful dream of my entire life, in which my great uncle Harry appeared. It was at the moment of his death. Of course, I didn't know that at the time, but he, in effect, took me on a little journey with him into the afterlife. And when I awakened from that dream, I was just crying tears of joy. It was so beautiful. And I was singing, spontaneously singing, one of the most sacred songs in the Jewish liturgy, And I wrote home and asked how Uncle Harry was, and that's how I learned he had died at that moment. And I also subsequently learned that Uncle Harry, unbeknown to me, was a mystic. I asked for an object, something that he owned so I could remember him by. And they sent me a book, a little book, and it said this was Uncle Harry's favorite book. And when I finally got it translated, because it was a book written in Yiddish, an obscure language, which is written with Hebrew letters, but is basically a Germanic language. It was the tales of the Baal Shem Tov, who was the founder of the Jewish Hasidic tradition. Hasidic means righteous, mm-hmm. But it's a mystical tradition within Judaism. And I became aware at that point that my Uncle Harry and even my own grandmother were followers of this tradition. But when they came over to the United States, of course, they wanted to blend in. Jewish people from Europe who came over in that era did everything they could to hide their Jewishness, really, so that they blended into American culture and they weren't perceived as somehow different. And so they never talked about any of this. I never learned about Uncle Harry's interest or my grandmother's interest in Hasidic Judaism until after they were dead.
Let me ask you, what made you...
Well, here, you were going to ask me about synchronicities.
And
the real synchronicity, I think, followed the dream from Uncle Harry. It was the second major dream of my young life. And because after that experience with Uncle Harry, I wanted desperately to change my career direction. I was headed towards getting a doctoral degree in criminology and probably working as a prison warden or something, or, you know, somehow in the social, the legal system, the system of justice. But once I had that dream of Uncle Harry and I realized it had something to do with the afterlife, something to do with his death, something to do with psychic phenomena, and something to do with a mystical approach to life, I realized that I could no longer continue on that path, that studying what I thought of as the negative side of human deviance was no longer going to work for me. I had to switch over to look at what I called the positive side of human deviance, meaning psychic functioning, mysticism, intuition, and creativity. And it wasn't like you could just switch majors and become a major in mysticism, intuition, psychic functioning, and creativity at the university. The truth is they had nothing along those lines, or other universities. And so I agonized for months and months. What am I going to do? And then one day, I knew that the answer was going to come to me. And this is the synchronicity. I just knew that I was going to have a dream that night and I would find the answer in the dream. I knew beforehand. I had a certainty. There was just no doubt in my mind. And indeed, I had this dream. I dreamt I was visiting friends in Berkeley. I knocked on the door of their apartment in married student housing, and there was no answer. And in my dream, I found a key, let myself into their apartment. Nobody was home, of course. Walked into the living room, and there in the middle of the living room floor, I found a magazine, picked it up, and it was named EYE. Which, parenthetically, there was such a magazine in those days. And as I'm paging through the magazine, I woke up with this feeling of exhilaration, like, wow, I got the answer now. But I didn't have a clue as to what the answer meant. So I did something very spontaneous and unusual. I acted out the dream. I put on my tennis shoes, ran 5 miles across town to married student housing, knocked on the door of this apartment where my friends Peter and Marcy lived. No answer, as I had dreamt, for synchronicity. And I did happen to know where they hid the key.
It was
second synchronicity.
Okay.
So I found the key, let myself into the apartment, walked right into the living room, and there in the middle of the floor of the living room was a magazine, third synchronicity, exactly as I had dreamt it. And here's an example of a dream distortion. The magazine wasn't named I, E-Y-E. It was named Focus. And it literally brought focus into my life.
Yeah.
At that moment, I began paging through the magazine. It was Focus. For viewers who live in the San Francisco Bay Area, they'll know it's the magazine of KQED, the listener-sponsored PBS radio and TV station in San Francisco. So I'm paging through it, and it dawned on me for the first time in my life, I could pursue my interests by getting involved in the nonprofit segment of the media, which was a huge shift for me, because if you had known me then, I was a long-haired hippie. I did not own a radio. I did not own a television. And furthermore, I was of the opinion, if you had asked me, that all electronic media is phony baloney, that the only authentic human communication is face-to-face. But I changed my mind then and there. And I said, I'm going to give this a try. And I went, because I lived in Berkeley, I went to the local nonprofit radio station in Berkeley, KPFA, of the Pacifica Network, and I said to them, I'm here to volunteer. I'll do whatever you like. And they said, oh, great. We'd love to have you sit here at this desk. And when you hear people ring the doorbell, push this buzzer and let them in the front door. And even though at that point I had a master's degree, yeah, I gladly did it. And within 2 weeks, I learned how to produce a radio program. And I produced my first program. It was, the concept was, you don't have to be from out of town to be psychic. Because I was interviewing, I had many local friends who were members of the pagan community.
So your very first program was about interviewing people?
I was interviewing psychics,
yeah,
local psychics about their experiences and members of the pagan and occult community. And the program director at the radio station liked that so much, he said to me, his name was Bill Schechner, who later became well-known in the Bay Area. He said to me, we've got a slot for you every Tuesday and Thursday at noon. There's a program called The Mind's Ear. And would you mind being the host of this program? So literally within about 3 weeks of my dream, I'm sitting at a table interviewing world-class experts in all the topics that interested me the most, people like Robert Monroe coming through town promoting his new book on out-of-body experiences, Journeys Out of the Body. Passing through, they all came to KPFA. We had a 50,000-watt transmitter with most powerful radio station in the Bay Area. And I'm interviewing these people, and I realized, wow, what a resource I have here. That gave me the confidence to go back to the university, where I knew there were some professors who were interested in parapsychology. But if I was going to learn about it, I had to do it on my own. I could expect a little help from the professors. It was mostly up to me. But I then went through the bureaucracy of setting up this individual interdisciplinary doctoral major, taking advantage of some obscure rules that if you're already a graduate student in good standing and you want to write a dissertation on a topic that no department is willing to sponsor, but you can find at least three faculty members across the whole University of California system, which had 12 campuses, you can have an independent, individual, interdisciplinary major. And so I did that.
Oh, yeah. So it seems like guidance or whatever you will call it brought you in this place where you were in contact with all the interesting people.
And what I tell people when I think about what is the lesson in all of this that I could share with people, it's that if you strive to become the best version of yourself, that's what the universe wants from you. It's going to be different for every person. But if that's what you aim for, the universe is going to help you one way or another.
The best version of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what I think synchronicities are ultimately about.
Thank you, Jeff, for telling the story.
You're welcome.
I think this is a good point to make at the end.
Okay.
Being the best version of yourself. For all of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you're the reason why we are here.
I imagine that by now, many of you already realize that, in conjunction with White Crow Books, we've just launched the new Thinking Aloud Dialogues book imprint, and our first title is There Life After Death? New Thinking Aloud is a nonprofit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.